Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, an update on New York State's prisons, which Radio Catskill's Julia Kim reports still have not fully recovered since the correctional officer strike ended in late February. Her in-depth report is coming up in the second half of the program. Also, Pennsylvania's budget has not passed. It's a couple of months late. How is that impacting local communities? Liam Mayo of the River Reporter fills us in. We start right now with a story that we've been following closely here on the local edition. Acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook has retained a high-profile attorney to represent him, largely pro bono, in a Texas lawsuit over New York's shield law. The New York Public News Network's Jesse King has this update.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican, sued Brook last month in an attempt to force him to file a summary judgment against Dr. Margaret Carpenter of New Paltz. A Texas judge found Carpenter liable for more than $100,000 in fines and legal fees for allegedly prescribing abortion pills to a Texas woman last year. Texas bans nearly all abortions. However, Brook has refused to file the judgment against Carpenter in New York in accordance with the state's shield law, which protects abortion providers from out-of-state lawsuits.
Since everything that the doctor did was legal in New York State, she never left New York State, our interpretation of the shield law made it pretty clear that we were not to comply with it.
New York is one of eight states to adopt shield laws since the fall of Roe v. Wade. Carpenter's case is considered the first major test of those laws, with some legal experts saying it could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Corcoran.
No.
Criswell.
I am a yes.
Brook has retained Andrew Celli Jr. of the nationally recognized civil rights firm Emery Celli Brinkerhoff Body Ward and Mazel. Last week, the Ulster County Legislature voted along party lines 14-8 to allocate $50,000 for Brook to find outside counsel. Here's Democratic legislator Lamina Grace Harmon.
Our job is to provide a defense for our employee that is at least as robust as the case being leveled against him. That is routine that we would seek outside counsel in extreme circumstances, which we know these are because this is a national issue.
Unbeknownst to the legislature, Celli had already been hired. Brook says Celli was technically retained August 1st to meet a mid-August filing deadline. Democratic Chairman Peter Criswell confirmed WAMC in a statement that the legislature didn't know this, but he stood by the body's decision to approve the funds, adding, quote, a majority of the legislature and many constituents who came to session or wrote in support the expenditure of funds to stand behind a county employee who was both doing his job and upholding New York state law, end quote. Brook says Celli has agreed to represent him pro bono once the $50,000 is depleted. He says no funds were dispersed at the time Celli was hired.
It seemed like at least members of the legislature knew we were questioned about it, why we were going with a New York City attorney instead of a local attorney. So I'm unsure why there's been reporting seeming like that was a confusion with everybody or some sort of scandal. Happy to clear up any confusion going forward. We certainly didn't keep any information from anybody intentionally.
Celli did not return a request for comment in time for broadcasts. A spokesperson for Ulster County says Celli was fully aware when he signed the retainer agreement that the funding hadn't been approved yet. The spokesperson says the reason the legislature wasn't kept in the loop was because the county attorney, who helped with the agreement, was away at the time.
Why wouldn't we just wait?
I can only tell you what I know.
Then why don't we legislator, just wait?
The eight Republicans who voted against the retainer funding last week cited multiple reasons for doing so, ranging from reservations about the case and the shield law in general to concerns that legal fees could balloon if the case makes its way to the Supreme Court. Republican legislator Joseph Maloney said the legislature should wait to move on the issue until it learns whether the county's insurance could potentially cover the cost.
I don't think this is a responsible decision. If our insurance company decides that he's indemnified, I'm all for him being covered and represented. If not, I think we need to have a conversation, and it probably would result in some kind of quick policy, because there could be shield-type laws on a lot of different topics coming down the line with states going different directions. So what are we going to do? Without any information, just keep throwing money out of our budget?
A motion to postpone the resolution failed. Democrats like legislator Kathy Nolan referred to the funds as a starting point, noting that the case is already underway.
There's certain things that when they're happening, you need to take an action now to stabilize it, to give yourself that room that you need for that better decision making.
Carpenter has largely refused to comment on the lawsuit. The Texas case isn't the only legal battle involving Carpenter. She also faces criminal charges for allegedly prescribing abortion pills in Louisiana. New York has refused to extradite her in that case. In Poughkeepsie, I'm Jesse King for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you to the New York Public News Network for that report. We now turn to Pennsylvania, specifically the Pennsylvania budget, even more specifically the fact that that budget is late. Wayne and Pike counties are not yet feeling the pinch from the delayed state funding, although local leaders are keeping an eye on the situation. Tim Bruno spoke with River Reporter News editor Leah Mayo live this morning on Radio Chatskill about the budget impasse and the potential impacts on Northeast Pennsylvania. Legally, the PA budget should have been completed by the end of June, but it's now September, and the Commonwealth still does not have a finalized budget. Spotlight PA reports the hang-up seems to be transit funding. But in the meantime, Liam Mayo explains that it's now at the point where regional agencies may not be getting the funding they were counting on, funding that can't be released until there's a final budget agreement, and even worse, there is no temporary agreement in place to at least start distributing allocated funds until the budget is finalized, as has happened in past years. So, how does this situation play out in our listening area in communities in Wayne and Pike County? Here's Liam Mayo.
We talked to Wallen-Popoc Area School District Superintendent Keith Ganeski, who said that the district has not been negatively affected at this time, and that with local property taxes already having been collected, those funds should see the district through the delay in state funding. We also talked to Michelle Young, the director of the Wayne County Family Center, which provides kind of early childhood care for children. She said that in the past, there have been family centers around the state that have had to either close or reduce their services due to budget delays, but she doesn't anticipate, or she said that Wayne County Family Center has never been among them and does not anticipate that being the case this time around either. However, she did say, quote, regardless, I'll rest easier when the budget is passed and funding is released for all the schools and vital programs that need this money. So people are concerned about what could happen if this disagreement continues and if the budget is continually delayed and if there are more missed payments, say, going into September. But people aren't generally feeling that impact as of this moment in time.
Are there any preventative measures being taken by county leaders to prepare for such a prolonged budget impasse?
Yeah, in Wayne County, Wayne County Clerk Andrew Sater told us that the county has put its department heads on notice that there is an issue with the state budget, but it hasn't yet asked department heads to cut any services. He did say that if the budget impasse goes on a couple more weeks, the county will have to talk about what steps it could take to weather the storm. So I think everybody is looking at this and everybody is preparing to potentially make some changes in services or preparing to shift some money around to make sure that services are not disrupted. But as of right now, they're still looking at, okay, we may need to do this in a couple of weeks, not we are needing to do this on a large scale at this moment in time.
And have you heard from local leaders about how they're attributing this delay? Is it solely to political disagreements or are there other factors at play?
Yeah, we heard from the Pike County Commissioner, Matt Osterberg, that this is basically politics and that he thinks it's a shame that political disagreements can cause such havoc on the local level. He said, quote, this is always disruptive to an entire community when they do this. So even though, you know, people might not be feeling direct immediate impacts, just the idea that this is something people need to prepare for is something that's weighing on people's minds in a way that it wouldn't necessarily need to if politicians at the state level could find more easy agreement.
Yeah, it looks like they weren't planning to be in session this month anyway. And Shapiro pointing fingers at the state Senate saying they haven't been holding enough voting sessions in Harrisburg. But he's also been saying at the same time over recent weeks that there's a budget deal that's close. So lots of pointing of fingers there back and forth over the budget issue and a real pain for local communities.
Yeah. And just to bring in sort of another local legislator's voice, one of the state senators for the Wayne Pike area is Senator Lisa Baker. And in talking about sort of the Senate's proposal, she said that their plan, which, you know, she's talking about the fact that the Republican proposals would divert money to roadwork and bridge infrastructure. The press release she put out said that their plan recognizes the need for mass transit funding, but not at the expense of the rest of the Commonwealth. The plan turns a necessary corner in the right direction by prioritizing equity in funding, ensuring small communities in rural areas also receive resources. So there's the idea that, prioritizing road work over sort of public transportation would help rural areas more, given that public transportation in rural areas is kind of less less common or less strong. But there are sort of still public transportation programs that would fall into that mass transit category. I believe that the medical transportation, like shared ride type programs, do fall into that category of mass transportation. And that is something that would operate in the Wayne Pike area.
That's Liam Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter, reporting on the Pennsylvania budget delay. You can read his reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, since the correctional officers' strike ended in late February, New York State prisons have yet to fully recover. During the 3 weeks of the unsanctioned strike, the prison system was completely upended. Inmates were confined to their cells for 23 hours a day, and virtually all programs from visitation and recreation to religious services and educational classes, they were all canceled. And now 6 months post-strike, prisons remain severely unsteady, with many of these programs still canceled or only just beginning to restart amid staffing shortages. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim has been researching what new challenges incarcerated individuals and their loved ones are facing on the ground and how post-strike conditions have come to expose pre-existing issues inside New York State prisons.
Back in February, New York's prison system was completely upended when correctional officers across the state went on an unsanctioned strike for 3 weeks in protest of staffing shortages and unsafe conditions. Spending up to 23 hours a day in cells became the everyday reality for many inmates during the strike as facilities went into limbo. From stopping visitation and recreation to canceling mental health treatment and educational and vocational programs. Despite it now being 6 months since the strike, Melanie Bishop, a social studies teacher in Livingston County and the mother of a son who has been incarcerated at Five Points Correctional Facility for 5 years, said conditions remain largely unchanged.
Most facilities are operating only an hour rec a day. Prior to that, they were doing morning and afternoon rec, so outside time is very limited at this time. There's frequent lockdown types a day. So there are days when they do not leave their cells in the max facilities except for that 1 hour a day of rec. So they're not going down to the mess hall to eat. They're not leaving for medical or mental health appointments. There's no jobs or programs running. So it really is like a constant lockdown. There, again, like no religious services. So my son hasn't been to a religious service since before the strike.
Following the strike, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, otherwise known as DOCS, has cited staffing shortages as the main reason for the pause on programs. And New York State continues to spend about $100 million a month on filling vacancies with National Guard soldiers. But this stalling has proven hazardous. Bishop, who has become actively involved in campaigns for prison reform with the decarceration nonprofit Center for Community Alternatives, said her son had nearly died during the actual strike after being unable to access medical treatment for a mouth infection and had entered the system already with issues with addiction, meaning ready access to medical and mental health treatment is critical now more than ever.
He was able at the last minute to get access to the antibiotics, and it took almost a week for the swelling to go down. We were told that he is on a call-out list because he needs some pretty significant emergency dental work. We've been told he's been on that for a while, even prior to the strike. When we wrote a follow-up probably about 2 weeks ago on a visit to medical, just kind of asking, you know, where does it stand? He was sent a message that basically said there's no dentist on staff anymore at Five Points, and there, if he has an issue, to put in a sick call. So I don't know. The honest answer is we hope that in the event of an emergency, he would be able to get access to medical treatment. But the confidence in the system itself right now is very low.
In the summer, he has raised his own set of issues. Bishop described that besides his $23 fan that is, one, often out of stock, and two, too expensive for many inmates, incarcerated folks like her son don't have many ways to escape the heat as they sit in their cells for most of the day. Upstate facilities like Five Points remain slower in reinstating programs compared to more downstate facilities. Max Kenner is the executive director of Bard Prison Initiative, an in-prison college program that has been able to grant over 900 college degrees to inmates since it was founded in 1999 and sees a nearly 0% rate of recidivism for the graduates. He explained that of the 7 correctional facilities the initiative currently operates in, they are close to being back to a regular schedule in some prisons, but they remain almost completely absent in others as they were during the strike and back during the COVID-19 pandemic.
The real tragedy of the strike, from our perspective, is that we have yet to fully recover in New York from the shutdowns of COVID. The staffing crisis began around the conclusion of the COVID shutdowns, continued at different paces in different places, up until the strike, and then culminated in the strike. So for incarcerated people across New York who've been working towards an education or towards a college degree over the last 5 years, that period of time has been pocked by relentless disruptions and shutdowns. And for us in New York, it's a special tragedy because we in New York should be proud of the fact that we have done more than any other state. People who run the prisons, religious communities, educators, formerly incarcerated people, we did more than anyone else over the last 25 years to restore college and prison after it was destroyed in the middle 1990s, to make education once again a central part of what we do in America's prisons, and build a system of college and prison that was the best in the country. Those were things we did in New York over a period of 25 years. And the tragic irony is that after we were successful in changing federal and state policy to restore college to the prisons across the country and here in New York, we have a more depleted system of college and prison that's in desperate need of repair because of the staffing crisis, the strikes, and the COVID shutdowns.
Alongside educational programs like BPI, visitation has become a particular point of concern for Bishop and other loved ones of incarcerated individuals because it largely remains limited to the weekends, leading to earlier commutes for her and other visitors to offset the now longer lines.
I visit my son every week. There's a lot of people who do. I visit their loved one once a week, and that's really the connection that we know is most impactful to reduce recidivism at the end. And my son used to get a visit one day a week on Wednesdays from his grandfather, who is aging. And that has been basically non-existent, or he's only been able to go once or twice since the strike ended, because a lot of our elderly people and young children have a really hard time standing in the much longer lines to get into these facilities. to see their loved ones. So we're definitely seeing people who used to visit once a week on like a Monday or a Tuesday because they're older or limited movement or whatever, are maybe going once a month. So their loved ones are missing out on those visits as well. I used to get there at like 7:30 in the morning to get in line, and pretty much the process went pretty smoothly. Now people are getting there at like 6:30 in the morning to stand in line. On Sunday, there was 88 people who visited. So people were coming in all the way up until about 2 o'clock, and that's an hour before visits end.
Although free phone calls have helped in alleviating the lack of human contact, these barriers to visitations have still raised challenges to incarcerated individuals. Melanie explained,
I would say that frequently I hear from my son that he tries to sleep the day, like there's nothing to do. He has voice concerns about whether he can do another 6 years just like this. There are, and he is not alone. Like there are so many family members who I feel like, you know, we're waiting for that call, you know, that bad call. And it doesn't even have to do with necessarily like somebody who already has mental health issues. Again, it's like across the board. If you don't get to see, you know, your loved ones that you usually see, if you don't get to see your, you know, parents or aging grandparents, and you don't get that hug and that physical contact.
Thomas Gant, an organizer for CCA who was formerly incarcerated for 25 years and had first become involved in the nonprofit while serving time, referred to current conditions as a humanitarian crisis. Before the strike, CCA had been able to meet with incarcerated members across the state in person to offer support, and now those visits have completely stopped. But what he deems dangerous is not just the conditions themselves, but the culture of hopelessness they're increasingly creating for inmates, especially as the murder of inmate Robert Brooks in Marcy Correctional Facility by officers had preceded the strike.
One of the worst things that you can ever do to a human is take away their hope. And so when these things aren't happening, it interferes, you know, with your hope. So when you just sit in the cell, as I said, for some folks we've heard for 23 hours a day, and heat, by the way, with nothing to do, is not only impacts a person's mental health, right? But also their you know, humanness. One of the things that DOCS is supposed to be providing is the opportunity to not only work on yourself, but to become more socialized, to become more better. So when you are released, you can give back to your community. And so that's not happening. DOCS is not actually training or helping folks to become better, which is what DOCS' job is. So instead, what you're doing is building a powder keg, right, of hopelessness, anger, you know, frustration, when people can't see their families, when people can't gain skills to kind of, you know, make themselves better. You're setting yourself up for a powder keg of disaster and destruction that DOCS and nobody else wants to see.
In a way, Gant explained,
so folks incarcerated do feel punished, right? They feel, you know, because they have to wear the brunt of the consequences from this strike. They feel like, you know, this wasn't our fault. You know, when you have staff who's trying to elude accountability, wanted to continue to move with impunity, they want to continue to kill and harm humans on the inside. And so because that has been disrupted, they decided to do the strike. And so now folks feel, oh, we're being punished now because they can't continue to act as monsters or treat us as inhumane. And so the rehabilitation that's supposed to be happening is kind of backwards now. It's like, well, you're going to be punished for being on top of here. On top of the sentence the judge gave you, we're going to even take away, you know, and roll back some of these things that's supposed to help you even more so.
In response to staffing shortages, DOCS has been aggressively recruiting for correctional officers throughout the state, from offering $3,000 sign-on bonuses for new recruits to lowering the minimum age to become an officer from 21 to 18. The department has taken the route of recruitment to try and respond to current conditions, according to New York Focus. But Gant, alongside Bishop, see the strike as exposing ongoing issues with prisons. It's not understaffing, but instead overpopulation that's the issue.
We know that statistically, New York State is one of the leading amount of states in the Department of Corrections who have more than enough staff to cover the folks that we have. And so the problem isn't understaffing. The problem is that 32,000 folks incarcerated is too many. And so the governor right now, at a swipe of a pen, just a swipe of a pen, she could alleviate some of this problem by using her executive powers and authority. And so I don't know if the governor knows this, so I guess I'll put it out there. But she has something called executive clemency power, because I'll tell you right now, there's thousands of folks sitting in prison right now that could come out and be meaningful contributors to our community. How do I know that? Well, they've already exemplified that during their incarceration so far within the last 10, 20, 15 years. She has thousands of applications on her desk where people who have been vetted and shown that I have not only the community support, but I have the record, I have the experience to say that I'm going to be in that group of people who are not going to recidivate, but also come out and be productive. People who have better resumes than me, and I spent 25 years in incarceration, plethora of accomplishments. There are thousands of folks who are incarcerated right now who could, if they're given an opportunity, will come home and I'm sure do far greater things than me.
CCA has been championing sentencing reform legislation, such as the Second Look Act and the Earned Time Act, as means of incentivizing good behavior by giving inmates opportunity to reduce their sentences. The Second Look Act would allow currently incarcerated individuals to have their sentences relooked and possibly reduced, while the Earned Time Act expands their opportunity to earn good time and merit time credits. For her son, who had applied for a drug alcohol treatment program when he first came into prison, only to be denied because he was seen as too early into his sentence, Bishop questioned simply investing in recruitment over expanding treatment services that put inmates on the path to leaving prison.
One of the main reasons I got involved in the Communities Not Cages campaign for Earned Time, because that would incentivize facilities to offer those programs when people enter the facilities. It's really hard to hear about staffing shortages or halt issues or safety concerns when it comes to contraband, when there is not access to programs to address addiction the way addiction needs to be addressed. We have to begin to treat addiction like the medical issue that it is and the mental health concern that it is. And until the facilities are willing and ready to do that, we're not going to see a big change in the people who are using that as a way to cope.
Gann argues that these two pieces of legislation, alongside the proper implementation of the HALT Act that had been a major reason for why the strike began in the first place, would work to not only alleviate the current crisis, but also genuinely improve conditions inside prisons starting from the root. The incentivization of good behavior and the emphasis on connecting inmates to opportunities to grow work to transform, quote, the culture, Gann explained. The very culture that had precipitated the strike in the first place, which she said was born out of a combination of abusive staff and a lack of hope given to inmates. But Gann said the lack of political courage by elected officials, especially Governor Kathy Hochul, to use her clemency powers and strongly advocate for reform has been key in keeping the status quo intact at the cost of incarcerated folks and their loved ones.
And it took me, right, getting out to understand that, because I was sitting around and I was thinking that, oh, well, this person's doing that. Look what I did. I got my college degree. Do you not know that in order to get my college degree, the amount of obstacle, hardship I had to go through every single day, verbal and mental abuse, just to be able to get down to my college class and do my work and to get back? When I became a sign language interpreter, the harassment that I had to face by walking down the hallway just to go doing something properly. The fact that I couldn't, you know, when I was a hospice worker, wanted to be able to talk to my family, loved ones, to share the value and importance of what life is and the fragility of it. And the fact that they weren't doing more to be able to allow me to share those things with people on the outside so they can take, you know. So I say all that to say that the environments that we have in prison today, whether you want to call them violent or hopeless, have been created because of the system of the Department of Corrections and the lack of creativity and willingness of folks on the inside who work there to want to create a better environment, right? You should do everything you can to want to keep a person connected to their family and loved ones. Being a part of your family, being a part of the community is what creates safety. When a person feels like they are part of something bigger than themselves, That's what creates real safety.
I just spoke with Thomas Gant of the Center for Community Alternatives, Melanie Bishop, a public school teacher and organizer for prison reform, and Max Kenner of the Barred Prison Initiative on the conditions inside New York prisons post-strike. In Liberty, I'm Julie Kim for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Julia Kim, for that report. And thank you, listener, for being here with me tonight. That's it for the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. We'll be back tomorrow night. Mr. Kusar Grace is coming up at 7 with Music Emporium. But first, we've got more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville.